it's about 6:15, so if the tape room is ready, we can begin. This is a session titled Special Interest Money, Special Interest Lobbying and the Selling of Our Democracy. It's an examination of how special interests and their money are corrupting our democracy. And I'm John Marty, a member of the State Senate in Minnesota since 1987, and I don't currently have a committee involved with campaign finance reform, but for a number of years I chaired a committee called Government Ethics and Campaign Finance Reform, and actually accomplished a few things at that time, but they quickly caught on and we stopped making progress. But this has been an issue that started influencing me from the beginning. I saw the first time I ran the impact of money in politics. I think a lot of us have been aware of that for a long, long time. I decided back in 1990, after I'd been in office 3 or 4 years, I decided I was going to personally change where I'd accept money from because of concerns about the process, and if nothing else, to make a statement. But I've seen since then a real belief that it does change the way we behave. I decided in 1990 I was going to accept no money from any political PACs or political action committees, which are the groups that every state has some form of them at the national level. They have some form of them where groups form a committee that makes campaign contributions. They are nonprofit groups, but a corporate firm may form a political action committee of its employees or its management or whatever, and they give money to candidates. I stopped taking money from them. I stopped taking money from lobbyists and from soft money, which is the money that flows not through the candidates, but it's given through independent expenditures or in other ways. It's not by candidate spending, but it's spending by an interest group or somebody else. You can't, strictly speaking, stop that, but you can make an attempt to stop people from doing it. And I didn't accept any contributions over $100. Done that ever since then, and it's doable in Minnesota with our public finance laws, which make it have spending limits for candidates and some public money. And I'm convinced that with our laws, we could have most candidates, with a slight change in the system, I think most of our candidates could survive, could run decent campaigns on public financing and the small individual contributions. When I ran for governor 15 years ago, I did the same thing. This was pre-internet, but we still kept the $100 per individual contribution limit, and we did succeed. We didn't win the race, but succeeded in raising well over $1 million in $100 contributions and less. 4 years later, they had a whole bunch of big-name candidates running. They all raised a lot of money, but the one that got the most contributions from the small individual contributors, like the ones I did, got 17% of his money from the sources that I would accept money from, and he was the one that got the most from small contributors. In other words, most of it does come from larger interest groups or lobbyists and so on. Because of some of my own interest in this, I've authored some campaign finance reform legislation and successfully passed, not due to my skill, but due to a scandal at the time, a ban on gifts from lobbyists to elected officials. Not even a cup of coffee is the way they describe the law now. Prior to that, I know one lobbyist reported spending $118,000 in the year or two before the law happened. That's $600 for every elected legislator in Minnesota. That was one lobbyist, and he did it giving tickets to professional sports games, he did it by paying for dinners, did it for all sorts of things. And it wasn't because the guy happens to be a particularly nice guy. I don't think of him that way. It's because he had a lot of clients that he was trying to represent. And so he saw his job as being a professional friend. But there's a ways to go. I mean, we've got Minnesota banned gifts, but they haven't banned campaign contributions of larger sizes. There are probably 4 or 5 states now, Arizona, Maine, a couple others out east, I can't remember, that have passed some clean campaign election laws, which means that the candidates who agree voluntarily to participate in them get virtually all of their money from public sources. And they agree to a spending limit, they agree not to raise any other money, and that's the way they run their campaigns. I'd say that that's a much better system if we can make it so virtually all the candidates participate in it. The U.S. Supreme Court has said we can't force somebody to abide by spending limits, but you can provide strong incentives for them to do so. In our state, again, almost every candidate abides by the contribution limits and gets the public financing. But basically, four or five states, plus Minnesota and a couple others, have some laws on campaign financing that make some difference. Every other state and the federal government has almost nothing. Federal law has nothing for Congress. The presidential campaigns have very weak laws. The big last dispute between the last 2 weeks is John McCain going to abide by it? He's now decided he will. I think, as of last I heard a few days ago, he's decided he will because he doesn't think he can raise that much more money than he'd get from the public money. Obama is now saying he probably won't. He's been able to raise a lot of money. It suggests that the limits aren't working. And at the federal level, they finally started about a year ago a new influx of elected officials in Congress, and they decided they were going to try a gift ban law like we have. They made some progress, but there were plenty of loopholes in it, which is often the way those things happen. One of the loopholes sounds innocuous enough, but you couldn't give any gifts to an elected official if you were a lobbyist unless they were a friend. In which case, the limit grew to $250 of gifts you could give somebody if they were a friend. So all of a sudden, friendships are breaking out all over Washington. And lobbying firms were getting legal advice on how they could qualify as being friends of people. Well, why does any of this stuff matter? What difference does it make? It depends who you talk to. The public thinks it's corrupt. Elected officials think it's not a problem. If you got a problem with it, it's because you don't have the courage or the guts or whatever to stand up to people who give you contributions. Minnesota Common Cause, which a group I think a number of you may remember from 20, 30 years ago, was fairly strong. They had a local chapter in Minnesota 10 years ago. They've just recently reconstituted it and trying to move forward. But they took a poll of Minnesotans and their impact, the perceptions of what campaign finance system, how it looks like. And the thing that most elected officials will say is, well, there's a perception of corruption, perhaps. Not really corruption, but there's a perception of corruption. And the Supreme Court has said we can deal with something that involves the perception of corruption. We don't have to show there's actual corruption. We have to show the perception of it, the appearance of it. And this Common Cause poll showed, they asked the question, are politicians more responsive to campaign contributors than to voters who do not contribute? I don't think people here will be surprised, but it was 88% said yes, they're more responsive to campaign contributors than to individuals. 6% disagreed and the others weren't sure where they were on it. But there's the appearance of corruption. Is there corruption as well? Yes. When I tried the gift ban in Minnesota, we had a limit that you had to disclose any gifts over $50. You're supposed to report the total you spent on food and entertainment of legislators. You had to report the totals, but only to an individual legislator if you spent more than $50. But one lobbying firm had represented the Minnesota Vikings football team, and every year they would invite every member of the legislature and guest to go to a Vikings game, and they had a dinner in the stadium beforehand and two tickets to a Vikings game. That costs a lot more than $50, and this firm didn't report any of that. And I asked somebody for a member of our campaign finance board, the board they report to, how they could get away with this, and well, they break it up into parts, you know. If Connie and I would go to a game, well, my ticket wasn't worth more than $50, and her ticket wasn't worth more than $50, and the dinner for her wasn't worth more than $50, and the dinner for me, and the free parking wasn't worth that, and all the other things, bells and whistles, the fact that it was in a luxury suite, that's separate from the ticket. They broke it down, and I told the guy that if that's the way you want to, they do it, you could give somebody a car, just break it down, each cylinder individually, and give them virtually anything. But They gave these gifts not because they wanted to lobby for at the Vikings games. My first year there in 1987, a lobbyist asked me, the Twins were in the World Series, asked if I wanted a ticket to a game, one of the games. And they were very, very hard to come by, as you can imagine. And I didn't choose to go. He was, I'm sure, would have gone with me, bought me a few beers, had a good time talking. And it wouldn't have been about political issues because it was our legislative session ends in May. This was in October. And frankly, you couldn't talk about anything of substance in there anyhow because people actually had hearing damage because of the noise and the volume in the Metrodome. So he wasn't going to lobby me there, but I'm sure it was just because, hey, he's a good friend of mine then. And the following year, when there are some issues up that some of his clients care about, John, could I have a few minutes to talk with you about this? And being human, I probably am more likely to listen to him. I think that's the reality of how the process works. I don't suggest that it's mainly corrupt politicians. There may be some, but if you try to pay off elected officials in Minnesota, I think more than most states, there would be very, very, very few who would accept it. Most would chase you away. But they somehow forget that when they're taking campaign contributions or other gifts, that maybe they're influenced subconsciously. It's not just in politics. The major media in Minnesota, at least, all their reporters are prohibited from accepting gifts from somebody they're reporting on. If you go out to dinner with a reporter, they pay their own way. It's just their rules. They're not allowed to accept one that way, and I think any responsible journalist would do that. We have everybody. It happens in the private sector too, but that's a private sector business issue. Do we want our employees to accept gifts from our suppliers? They might be giving favored treatment to some, and most businesses do crack down on it. But we see it in public life. I've been working on the issue of pharmaceuticals. Drug manufacturers give large amounts of gifts to elected officials. And this year we had a hearing on that issue in my health committee, and one of my colleagues who's been around for a long time said, well, we've had a ban on that. They can't do that. They can't give you anything. And one of my colleagues who works as a psychologist up in Duluth said, well, you know, every Friday at the clinic is pizza day because one of the drug companies will come in and supply pizzas to everybody for lunch. How they do that? Well, there are loopholes in what the law covers and there are gaps in it. Another one of my colleagues who is married to a doctor said that they routinely are offered trips to the Bahamas for a conference. They can attend the conference, and it's more vacation than conference, but they can go to it. But what happens? They tend to prescribe drugs that manufacturers trying to sell. I think it hurts our healthcare system, the quality of healthcare, and it's a clear conflict of interest. And doctors themselves are speaking out. Some Harvard doctors this year said, disclosure is not sufficient. Small gifts are not acceptable. They say we've got to change it. If we care about our profession, we better change it. And politics works the same way. Let me give you an example of one case that it happened last year, 2 years ago, but it really spells out pretty well what happens. There's a New Jersey business developer named Ziggy Wilf, who decided he liked making campaign contributions to Minnesota politicians. In the year 2006, he gave our state House of Representatives Republican Campaign Committee $6,000. He gave the Republican Senate Victory Fund, the Republican caucus, and the Senate $6,000. For some reason, he only gave the Democratic caucuses in each house $5,000, but he gave to both parties. He gave to the Republican and the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, gave them $5,000 each. He gave the Democratic and the Republican parties $20,000 each. Now, we all know people who may give to a candidate who's a Democrat, vote for a candidate who's a Republican, they're independent voters, but very, very few people are going to give money to one candidate and to their opponent. Even fewer are likely to give money to one party and the other party. Why did Ziggy Wilf, who's a New Jersey businessman, decide to do this? Well, the year before, he bought the Minnesota Vikings. And he decided he wants, as his predecessor owner did, he wants to have the taxpayers pay about $500 million for a new stadium for them because well, we care about the Vikings and we want them to stay in Minnesota, and we hope that we can keep them here, and we can if you build us a new stadium. So he spent that year, I think it was about $89,000, $90,000 he spent in 2006 in spending money for the campaign. He hasn't gotten his stadium yet. We had a budget deficit last year. He is trying again this coming year. It's an election year. He's less likely to do it. I think what he's more likely to do is make even more campaign contributions and then try again in 2009. Is that okay? Well, if he did it in the football league, if he decided, well, we want to build some friendships, his lobbyist said that Vice President of Stadium Development and Public Affairs, who's their lobbyist, said, bottom line, why did we do it? Because we were asked. He said it should be seen no different than the team's charitable work, part an effort to participate in the fabric of the community. We just view it as part of the process, nothing more, nothing less. Well, if he tried to decide that, you know, we want to be generous, some of the officials in the NFL are, they got kids in college, they got other expenses, you know, why don't we give them $1,000 before the games? I think we know what would happen. The league has rules against those things. I have a feeling the team owner would be heavily punished and the officials would be kicked out of the league. Why? Because they would throw the game to the person who gave them the money? You don't have to wait for proof of that. It's simply clear evidence that there's a conflict of interest, so it's not allowed. But in politics, we work under a different basis, and that is that it's innocent until you can show beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody sold, that there was bribery going on. The fact that it is simply a candidate's campaign contributions and they voted for something that the person wants, well, that person was giving them money because they wanted to elect people they agreed with. Well, Ziggy Wilf was not giving money to the Democratic and the Republican parties because he wanted them both to win. He was giving money so he had all the bases covered. And that's the way it tends to work in politics. I guess before I go on further, I will tell a few more examples. But if you were elected official and you heard Ziggy Wilf was giving out campaign contributions, what do you think people would have? What do you think candidates do? What do you think happens because of that? Is there any impact? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Nobody today.
If they're going to listen to their argument, they're going to open their office and give them a little bit more time.
A little more time, perhaps.
How do you know?
You can't. Yeah, how do you know? Is there, unless they sign a document, here's a campaign contribution, you vote for this, sure, here I'll sign it, I'll vote for it.
Sometimes I wonder why companies buy ads, because how do they know? Well, they must have studies that they can influence your...
Yeah.
I was going to say, as a candidate,
I would
think, my opponent is getting this money, and I've got to raise money. And then, of course, once you take it the first time, then it's part of your budget for your next campaign. You're expecting it, and it's
just simple. Yeah, it's not something that a candidate who receives the money isn't crooked. That's the way our system works. It's just that's where you get your money. Our system rewards people. The presidential campaigns now, you hear, I think they had a Pioneer League for George Bush, where those were people who raised over $100,000 for him, because now the limits are you can only give, it's $2,300 to a presidential candidate per person for the primary and that much for the general. That's all you can give them, and that's too much of a limit for some, so what they do in order to raise millions of dollars, they have, in that case, in 2004, they had pioneers. People would go out and raise $200,000, somewhere in that range, for the campaign, and they would be honored in various ways and get more access and so on. But the people who give the money are doing it sometimes because they believe in the person. I really like this candidate or this party or this philosophy. Sometimes they're doing it because perhaps they want something in return for it. And candidates who accept the money, that's the way the process works, so they accept the money. So I lay out the premise that it doesn't require corrupt people in this process. You can be not corrupt and still accept the money. You can be not corrupt and still give the money. It's legal, technically speaking. It's absolutely legal. But that doesn't mean that there's not a corruption problem. It's a corrupt system. Again, the same thing, a doctor who accepts gifts from a pharmaceutical manufacturer is not corrupt for doing so. The manufacturer is not corrupt for doing it, but it's a corrupt system that allows it to happen. That's why I think we ought to, as a society, we have a right to clamp down on it. And if a judge, we have some rules, not very tight rules for judges. I think most judges have a code where if some party to a case gives them money, they see it as clear conflict of interest. In Minnesota, we do have sort of judicial elections, and the campaign contributions, the judges have a standard policy that they are not involved in any way in the fundraising, and whether you can believe it or not, they say they don't even know who gives the money to their campaigns. They have independent groups of lawyers doing it. Of course, the people who want to head those groups because they get seen as being helpful are lawyers too. But that's the way we have a stake in this, because even if it is perception of corruption, that means people are less likely to vote, less likely to participate. They give up on their democracy. But I argue it goes one step further than that. I'd say that it does change behavior. Minnesota Vikings, I mentioned earlier, the Minnesota Twins wanted a new stadium too. It took them from 1987 when they started pushing for one until a year ago before they got $420 some million for it. And back then they made campaign contributions year after year after year. It was interesting, the team owner and his three sons, at the beginning they'd all write checks, and they'd do the same thing where they'd write checks to both parties, both caucuses and the legislature. And then they realized, because some of us said, look, they're just trying to buy favors, that, oh, they decided some of them would be Democrats and some would be Republicans. So he and one of his sons gave to the Democrats, and the other two gave money to the Republican Party. And that way they could say, oh, no, we just are giving to people we believe in. They just happened to be all written the same date, the checks, and they all seem to be equivalent amounts. But that's the way they try and do it. And they did win a stadium. I believe it was partly because of that. Well, what are the solutions? What do we have to do about it? It's not something that we are likely to get success in the near future. Supreme Court has made it clear, and there was actually a campaign finance case in the last couple of weeks that's making it even more difficult. But they argue, and they've decided 20-some years ago, that we cannot limit spending in campaigns by mandate. We can limit it through incentives. You can accept public money in exchange for agreeing to a spending limit. Minnesota, we've carried that further so that if you agree to the spending limit, you get the public finance money, which is substantial, and if your opponent doesn't agree to it, they get to skip the limit, but so do you. So you get to keep the public money, but you're freed from the limit too. That gives an extra burden. You're going to be behind in the game if you're not going to accept the limit, so it's much heavier burden for a candidate to go outside of the limit. So there are ways we can get around it. I think fundamentally we have to fight. I believe that the Supreme Court is right that the First Amendment, the right to free speech, is critically important. That's the centerpiece of our democracy. But they're wrong about how you change, how you influence the First Amendment. They say the purpose, in one of their cases in 1976, the Buckley-Vallejo case, the main one on campaign financing, they said that the point of the First Amendment is to make sure that in the political realm we have as many, as widely diverse views as possible from as many sources so people have a full range of positions to consider. And I think that is essential in a democracy, and that's what the First Amendment's about. You don't want to say, well, two major parties get it, nobody else does. But what they don't realize is that spending, which they've equated with free speech, in other words, if I'm a corporate interest and I'm going to make campaign contributions, I, as a corporation, have a right to free speech. And you have all the same rights I have, but if you don't have the money, you don't get to be heard. And they're right that money, to a certain point, allows you to be heard, but the overall impact of the money in our system shuts out a lot of voices. Candidates who have more, who have views that aren't in line with more wealthy financial interests, they don't even bother to run. They can't raise the money. You ask candidates why they're not going to run for a race, it's often, I couldn't raise the money. So it shuts out certain people from running. It also limits a lot of which issues you talk about. I've got a healthcare reform bill that the health insurance industry is not particularly fond of, the pharmaceutical industry is not particularly fond of. They're not going to give me money on it if I would take it. They've written me off. They would be glad to give to my opponent. So it shuts out people. A lot of candidates say, you know, I've got to run. I need money to win a campaign. I'm not going to talk about those issues. Or if I talk about them, I'm going to tone down my rhetoric. So in effect, we've shut out a lot of views because of the campaign financing law. The fact that we have more money coming into some candidates means they can crush. If you have 10 times the money your opponent has, nobody's going to hear your opponent. You can have a few debates. You probably don't even want to bother with debates because you're going to give your opponent some access to the media. Instead, you just run ad after ad after ad that don't really educate people, at least not fairly, but you get your voice out there. So I think the Supreme Court, which has told legislators in the past that if you can make the case on why this compelling interest in ending corruption and whatever overwhelms the concerns about free speech, they will listen. They say, we are not the experts in campaign financing, we're experts in First Amendment. And I think that's right. We have to show them how the impact of money on campaigns is diametrically opposed to what they're trying to accomplish with the First Amendment. But even if we don't win on those constitutional issues, we can, within the framework they've spelled out, we can reform our system and do what I think Arizona and some of you may live in the states that they're from, but they have clean money candidates, and candidates advertise, I'm running as a clean candidate. And that's the simplest thing we ought to be doing in terms of public money. We should be putting some public money in exchange for allowing people to accept only small contributions from individuals and spending limits.
What does clean candidate mean?
Clean candidate means they will only take that clean money, the money that's largely public money in those states. It's interesting because most people who hate politics don't want any of their tax dollars to go into campaigns. Right after the 1992 Perot campaign, a lot of the Ross Perot people, independent, I think they formed a party out of it, it's called United We Stand. It was a group of, they were mainly people in their 60s and so on, and they were cranky about government. They didn't like the corruption in government, and they thought Ross Perot was going to save them from this. But they formed a group called United We Stand America, and I had a campaign finance bill in 1993 that went by my limits, just $100 maximum from anyone, no PAC, no lobbyists, no soft money. I thought it was a good bill. They came in saying they wanted to support my bill. And I'm thinking this is some sort of strange third party that's very cynical about politics, so I was kind of busy. I didn't set up a time to meet with them. They insisted, we really want to meet with you. We'll come to the Capitol wherever you want. We want to meet with you. And I agreed to do so, and they said, well, we're really interested in your bill. Tell us about it. We want to endorse your bill. And I spent 5 minutes telling them where you could get the money and where you couldn't get money under it and why that's important. And they were all nodding their heads. They all agreed. And then I said, but if you're going to do this, it takes money to run campaigns to get your word out. Not as much as we spend now, but it takes some money. And we have to have a fair way of getting it out. And I'm suggesting, and this bill would call for more public money, more of your tax dollars going to candidates that you can't stand. And I said, I don't want your support for just the limits if you're not going to replace it with something. I want you to support the whole thing because I think it's in your interest. If your tax dollars are funding the campaigns of both sides, or all the sides, if they're funding the campaigns, and then they're beholden to the public instead of to the interests who can finance their campaigns. And I spoke half an hour about that, and later on they contacted me and told me that, yes, They were endorsing my bill with the public money. I think people are willing to spend their tax dollars to have a clean system, and that's what Arizona voters, I think they did that by initiative. I think in Maine, I'm not sure if it was the legislature by initiative, but a number of states have done that, and that's the direction we have to go. There are plenty of groups like Common Cause that are reinvigorating themselves. I don't think they have a hard sell with the public. The numbers I quoted earlier, about 88% saying they think candidates are more, they feel more obligated to listen to people who give them money than people who don't. People understand that. When I offered, I mentioned earlier, this gift ban from lobbyists, it was not very well received. It was very poorly received. The Senate decided that year that the committee I was chairing had to vote on it because I was pushing the bill, and or scheduled hearings on it. They had to vote for it. They thought, well, it's never going to pass anyway, so we'll vote for it. Got to the Senate floor, and everybody got kind of scared and figured the House will kill the bill anyhow. The House bill was, I didn't have a companion bill, a similar bill in the House. The bill that was moving in the House was disclosure of anything over $25. And they knew the House wouldn't take my bill, so they didn't want to vote against it because they know what the public feels. They may say nobody cares about it, but they were scared to vote against it because it would look like they were on the take. So they all voted for it. I mean, it may have been one or two no votes, maybe one or two. And the House decided, well, the House was up for election that year, and they weren't going to play games with it. And they said, if the Senate's going to play that kind of game with them, they'll play the same game with the Senate. So the guy called me up and threatened me if I didn't pull the bill back, he was going to hurt me in some way or another. To the point that I actually taped on a dictation machine part of the phone call because I thought getting threatened like that was worth keeping track of. But I said, you know, when you're ready, when you pass your bill, we can have a conference committee work out the differences between the two bills and just call me and tell me when you're ready. And he said, well, we're not going to change your bill. If we're going to take it up, if you're not going to call it back, we're going to pass it just the way you did. And I'm thinking, well, fine with me. I kind of liked it. And it passed the House with maybe one no vote. And it became law. And the next year, all my colleagues, not all of them, about half of them, were really grumbling about how unfair this was and how lousy this thing was and looking for ways to weaken it. And it passed because they voted for it, and they voted for it not because they thought it was a great idea. I had many people say, you think I can be bought for a $50 lunch? You think I can be bought for that? If you got a problem with that, maybe you shouldn't be in politics. But I can't be bought for that. And so they fought against it. But I think that Congress was right. They took some steps. I mean, with the reforms they were talking about with earmarks and so on, they made some steps forward for the first time in many years. But there's a long way to go with all of this. And I could talk more about other things like the fact that a lot of my former colleagues they leave the legislature and they go into lobbying. I had a cooling off period bill that was going to require, if you left the legislature, 2 years at least before you could come back and lobby your former colleagues. It actually died on a tie vote on the Senate floor, and I think if the media had covered it, wasn't a single article about it, if the media had covered it, I think people would have gotten scared and I could have tried it again, but there was no coverage, no sanction for somebody voting against it. But there are a whole lot of issues like that we should be addressing as well. But I think it would be more helpful if we open it up for a discussion. And it can relate to any of this. It can even relate to things like the pharmaceutical industry, which has a very similar problem. Yes?
I'm wondering, has your stand, because I mean, you're known throughout Minnesota for your good government stance, and does it affect leadership positions? Does it affect, do people run the other way when you're coming? I mean, sometimes I know the media has been less than kind by your level of ethics, so.
The St. Paul paper, when I ran for governor, said I was honest to a fault and therefore endorsed my opponent, which I thought was, I thought it was supposed to be a compliment, but they didn't see it that way.
Didn't they call you a Boy Scout, and that's like a bad thing?
They called me all kinds of things, not always nice. But No, I think, first of all, a lot of legislators don't like what they have. It's more of a problem at the national level. You'll have a lot of, I'm sure, more House members now saying they're not going to run again because the amount of money they need to raise. I know a number of U.S. senators who decided, you know, if you want to run again, one of them, Paul Simon from Illinois, who died 5-6 years ago, he said when he decided not to run in 1996 for re-election, he said he announced about 4 years, 5 years earlier. He said at that time $6 million, he said, would be required to win a U.S. Senate re-election in 1996. And in order to do that, that's $1 million a year divided by roughly 50 weeks. If you take a couple weeks off, it's $20,000 every week you have to raise for 6 years to get $6 million. Well, in Minnesota, which is a state about a third of the big now, the projections are that both of the U.S. Senate candidates will be spending $15 to $20 million each. Illinois, I don't want to think of how much they spend on the races there, but there's no limit, no... So candidates are saying, I don't want to be on the phone all the time calling people asking for $1,000 contributions, which is both parties have offices right outside, right off of Capitol Hill. They buy space right there, so between votes or something, members of Congress can cross the street and go there and spend a couple hours every day dialing for dollars. What a way to run a democracy.
How about the internet?
The internet, well, that's showing, that's where people believe in a candidate. I mean, you look at the presidential races here, all the candidates are blowing away records because at least the candidates have been successful, have been, because they've got people who are giving by the internet. That could help even things out some. It still doesn't fix the fundamental problem that money is talking about elections. But most candidates don't like it this way. They don't really want to change it, though, because that's how they got elected, the elected officials. They like it that way. But, the gift ban, a lot of my colleagues still don't like it. But again, we've had heavy turnover. Most legislators there now didn't live there before. They had bagels. This one lobbyist brought in bagels every morning to all the key offices, donuts or bagels and coffee. Just bring it into each office suite. And when the interns told a former staff member of mine, who's the bagel man? And, he's not a bagel man. He's a lobbyist. He just brings food every day. He brings in bagels and coffee and so on. And they don't know that. The most existing legislators were not in office 14 years ago when that happened. But they've heard good things about it. At least some of them have. Most of them say, oh, I wouldn't want to go to those receptions. Wouldn't want to go to that anyway. But they don't like it. And again, the ones that understand it say they wouldn't change it at all. They like it okay. They've never known anything else. The campaign finance limits, a lot of them would like to. They're very worried they can't raise the money. They know their opponents can raise large amounts of money. But I think there's a lot of people, I'd say a third of the legislature, half the legislature would be happy to support reform. The leadership isn't, though. The leadership gets its power from their caucuses. The caucuses raise all this money, and both parties, one caucus leader wrote to their caucus members, the reason lobbyists and PACs contribute to our campaign efforts are so they can interact with our members. This is not possible if you're not present at these events. They want you to be present at the events so they can talk with you and schmooze with them and make the connections and raise issues with them. And that's the way the political system works. So a lot of the newer members are saying, we don't like it, it stinks, and we agree we'd like to change it. But leadership defends what they've got. So that's one of the reasons.
To what extent do you think that the length of various campaigns contributes to this problem?
It's a big part of it. Simply because the biggest way we spend money in American politics now, at least in statewide and congressional district races and bigger, is through television ads. There is only so many hours of the day and so many channels on the TV to buy advertising on. And if you look in the week or two or three before an election, that's about all they have. And candidates are ad after ad after ad. When the campaigns last, like this year, the presidential primaries occurring beginning early January on, they've got a lot more time to run a lot more ads. And so I've been in favor of keeping our campaigns as short as they can. Like our primary in Minnesota, our non-presidential primaries for U.S. Senate and governor and legislature and everything else, is September, the second week of September, only 8 weeks before the general election. Both parties, interestingly, a lot of the interest groups, everybody else is trying to move the primary to June. Why? Because the parties spent all this time fighting against each other, and the public doesn't even get to begin to hear the issues discussed in a broader method until only 8 weeks before the election. Well, I point out basically the main change that would occur is we'd start having the ads for the primary, which started in July and August, most recent years, would be now starting in March or April. And they just stretch it all out, and the problem with the ads is not only that they don't portray any accurate information, or they rarely do, but the problem with the ads is that people get so sick of them that they give up on paying attention to the campaign before they ever start paying attention to the issue.
And if you had the primaries in June, the general election ads would start immediately.
Yes, and they would start right away. Yeah, that's right. So it's, I think I fought against it successfully. We kept that off. But both political parties and a lot of the big donors and all the media consultant types and the news media itself, which loves the ads, have a stake in moving it forward. But by using the argument, how long of campaigns do we really want? The public's overwhelmingly opposed to that. So instead of saying, oh, we need more time for the voters to focus on the general election, we've been able to beat that back by saying, do voters really want longer campaigns? Yeah, that's pretty clear. Voters do not. Yes?
A lot of the examples that we've used, we talk about, of course, of these larger races, like the Senate races. But, and I don't know the specifics in Minnesota, but I know in many states you have part-time legislatures that are only in session for 6 months a year or whatever. They have to travel long distances to live, and they're not paid well, they're not paid. And so a lot of them, you know, they're basically stuck in the Twin Cities, let's say, and they're from Duluth, and they're on a shoestring, and somebody gives them a free meal and ticket to a Vikings game. It's not so much, you know, it's sort of like, well, this is just getting by.
Right.
And is that a part of it, too? Not only the finance, but don't we have to pay living salaries to the legislators to make it to where they're not doing it simply to survive?
That would help. That would help a lot. In Minnesota, the pay, the way we've gotten around, people are scared to vote for pay increases because they're sure the public will penalize them. So a number of years ago, they created this compensation council of a whole bunch of private citizens and so on, determine what they think is fair. They come back every year with a report that says they should be significantly higher, and then the public can't vote for it. And so then some states try things, and I think Minnesota tried at one point saying, well, we pass it so that their recommendations become law unless we object. Well, then the way they stop it is if you can keep it from coming up on the floor, then they say, well, we're going to vote against the appropriations to make this happen. And so they keep it off that way. But I think it is a legitimate issue. You don't want wealthy people and retirees to be the only people who can afford to serve in public office. Campaign contributions, part of it, it should have nothing to do with that. But the gifts, I'm all in favor of doing it. But what they do instead of the salary is they increase the per diem payment, the daily payment when we're in session and when we're meeting in committee. And it's pure and simple part of the salary. But they're able to do it that way and say it's not part of the salary, it's expense, but it's separate from what we get reimbursed for expenses. So it's a good point. Other things? Yes?
Do you think that because of the situation we have ourselves in order to get elected, you have to go after financing, you have to be very aware of it, you've got to be oriented that way. Has it affected the quality of the candidates? I mean, who in their right mind wants to
go through this? Some people wonder. There are a lot of people who don't want to put themselves through it. Again, the issue in Congress, when people have to go to a little cubicle office right outside their congressional office for a couple hours and just phone, that's not a lot of fun. It's certainly not glamorous. And there are people who are very qualified who say they won't put up with it. So yes, it does hurt the candidates that way. And again, some of the best It also hurts the fact that members of Congress who spend their time doing that instead of meeting with the public, it's a lousy way to do it, and I can't think of any bigger problem for our democracy than that, in terms of who wins elections is determined by how much money there is. The Republican Party had more money than Democrats most years, and they were trying to create this into a permanent majority. Tom DeLay and others, they formed this K Street project, which was to get the lobbyists on K Street, where a lot of the offices are, get them to stop giving money to both sides, what I mentioned to you earlier. They said, it's not good enough for you to give us money. If you keep giving money to the Democrats who aren't in power, we're going to shut you out just as if you didn't give us any money. You've got to give us. And they tell them how much they expected from them. And it was extortion kind of thing. But they were getting away with it. All of a sudden, they overreached, and they're not in power anymore. And now is the time, I think, we got to step forward and make some campaign finance reform. But it does hurt the quality of candidates.
One of the arguments being made in Wisconsin, where we're seeing all of this real personal antagonism and the issue sharpening where one side wants to demolish the other, is that because of the campaign financing and the lobbyists, you're no longer getting the person in the middle able to run for office, but rather you get the people on the extremes on each side simply because they draw the majority of the money. So you now don't have these people who will cooperate in a personal way and maybe produce bills somewhat in the middle, but you get these extremes, and that's another consequence of not having adequate
campaign finance. I wouldn't argue that it's ideological extremes one way or another. It tends to be more financial based. In healthcare side, they're more concerned. People who work in low-income clinics, they don't have any campaign contributions to give. The insurance industry has a lot of money to give. So you get people who are interested in the insurance industry's position, not the low-income clinics' positions. It definitely does color what is heard, who the issues we talk about. The antagonism becomes bad because political consultants have found out the more you attack somebody, as long as it doesn't look like it's coming from your candidate, you can attack, you can get away with it. It discourages the other side's supporters from going out to vote. It depresses turnout. I've been trying to convince my own party to set up some policies against the party running ads that are negative against the other side. I think if you wanted to have an objective standard that you could have a voluntary campaign code on, would be that any attacks on the opponent have to be through the mouths of your candidate. Because the scary ads and the haunting music and so-and-so let the prisoners out that went and raped and murdered somebody, you're not going to have a legislator or a candidate go out and say, my opponent let these guys out of prison and did you know this? You're not going to run the scary music in the background because it's going to make your candidate look, their voice sound grim with haunted music. So if you want to have a forum debate, which you ought to have, that's one thing, but the name-calling, the vicious attacks, they make up issues if you don't give them any issues to run on. And so that, you come to the legislative session then, and the other side is throwing all kinds of mud at you, and you kind of think, I don't have anything to do with it. And you respond in kind, and that's what's partly destroying it. It's people who respond in kind to it, and I think we got to clean up the campaigns if we want to turn down the rhetoric in politics.
But I think the argument is also that this money does draw the people on the more extreme right and left, and they are more likely to put up with these sort of attacks on the other side, where the story in Wisconsin is, remember, you know, Gaylord Nelson and Mel Laird, who were very much on opposite sides of issues, and they served together in the state, and then on the national level when Gaylord Nelson was senator and Mel Laird was Secretary of Defense, you know, they would disagree, but they would go out to dinner after. And those types of people who came more from the center part of their parties were less likely to want to put up with these kinds of
You might be right. I don't sense it that way, because the example I give is Paul Wellstone, Minnesota's former. Clearly, people consider him the most progressive senator in the Senate. Mm-hmm. He started out with an antagonistic attitude. He knew he wouldn't like Jesse Helm, who was Jesse Helms, who was the most conservative member, and later on they found out they really liked each other. They didn't get along on any political issue, but they could have dinner together afterwards. I mean, I feel all kinds of times. I don't see antagonism more from people who are in extremes or anything. There are some people who are, but mostly they're not getting elected to office. It tends to be not extreme against extreme. It just tends to be certain personality, perhaps, and people who are bitter because they see how, understandably bitter, perhaps, but they understand how people were throwing mud at them. And they just respond, and it doesn't matter. It's not ideologically based as much as it is it's digging in the partisan lines, even when there's no difference between the parties on an issue. It's still making people, I'm going to stick together with my folks because it's their team fighting a war against our team. Mm-hmm. But a couple more things. Anybody else? Yes?
This isn't a frivolous question, but it's a little personal. Since we sort of live in Minnesota, but we live in Golden, Illinois, with your values, is that why you went to Minnesota to be a politician instead of in Illinois?
I went to college in Minnesota, and all my friends moved up from Northfield to the Twin Cities, and I did too, and met Connie there a year later, and we decided we're going to live in Minnesota, and I frankly would much prefer to live in Minnesota than Illinois. Back then our schools were much better. I think we had a much better quality of life. 1970, Time magazine cover story, Minnesota, the state that works. I mean, it really was, and to a certain point still does, though. Every advantage we've had on environment, on education, on healthcare, and so on, we're kind of slipping down to where other states are because we're relying on the fact we used to have the best laws in the country, and oh, we're still much better than everyone else in environmental whatever. We still have that problem.
You had the Minnesota miracle.
Yeah, yeah. Those things happened in the early 70s. We were the state that works, and I've been in the legislature 22 years and been watching it go down. My opponents don't use that against me, but I don't think I'm the one who's causing it to go down. But we've definitely been on the decline in a whole lot of issues that matter.
I'm just thinking about the non-incumbent candidate for senator in Minnesota, and I've heard that he's getting a lot of money coming in from outside of Minnesota. And I don't know if my sources are correct or not. But anyway, what are people wanting of him?
Right.
That they're...
Oh, it's the same thing. Both parties, every candidate for U.S. Senate and growing number of candidates for U.S. House, money's coming from all over the country. If you're an interest, if you are auto industry, that's been fighting one of my bills on auto emission standards. If you are an automaker and you want to oppose legislation like that, it doesn't matter whether... They don't have to have any manufacturing plants in my district or even car dealerships. They got plenty of them, but it doesn't matter where my district is. I'm one vote in the legislature, and they will put money into my opponent if they think they can knock me off. Same thing in national politics, any interest group in the country. If they get a candidate who they think is going to be with them on some of the issues or it switches party and they want that, they will give money to that candidate. They'll give money to the other one. They have no stake. I mean, when I use the example of Ziggy Wilf, a New Jersey investor in Minnesota politics, because I was trying to show he doesn't care who he gives money to. He doesn't. If he has a home in Minnesota, he's not giving money to legislators from that district. He's giving money to anybody who chairs the right committees, the leadership people, the governor. But it's part of the problem. Businesses and interest groups are finding out politics makes big decisions. Pharmaceutical industry between 2000 2004, when Medicare Part D passed, they spent $180 million on lobbying, campaign contributions, and television issue ads related to passing their legislation and to candidates who are supported. $180 million, the bill that passed, the one that they passed in 2004, 2005, was one that said that the government was going to buy all these drugs from all these manufacturers for seniors. They were going to buy them, but we are prohibiting our own government from negotiating lower prices. So if the manufacturer says, we want to charge you this much money, we're going to pay it. How much is that worth to them? Boston University did a study when it passed. They estimated the net gain for the pharmaceutical industry. The increase in profits over 8 years would be $160 billion. That's almost $1,000 of higher profits for every $1 they spent in lobbying and campaign contributions. That's a good investment, and that's what they see it as. And every business is seeing, we put a little more money into the political process, we get a lot out of it. Or we stop a lot of bad things from happening from our perspective. It's a good investment, so they're putting more and more money in, and it doesn't matter what state they're in. South Dakota, $100,000 to help a candidate in South Dakota in the U.S. Senate has the same vote that the U.S. Senator from California has, where it might take $20 million to have the same impact. So they dump a ton of money into the tiny South Dakota, but 99% of the money comes from outside the state in the U.S. Senate races.
I can't figure out why ARP backed that.
Why what?
Why ARP?
AARP?
Yeah.
They're now an insurance company. I mean, they do lots of other things, but they are an insurance company on health insurance.
I told them, I says, if you're going to do that,
It was a crooked bill. It was a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. And you look at how many of the authors, the committee chairs in Congress who were working on that legislation are now working for the pharmaceutical industry at $500,000 a year salaries. It was worth it to the industry. You just promise them a job afterwards, or you kind of wink, wink, we really like you. It's crooked. But if you want to make a lot of money, you can leave Congress, make $500,000 a year, just be really nice to an industry, and afterwards they'll thank you.
You may have to correct me if I'm wrong here, but when Tim Pawlenty was he a congressman or a senator?
State house member, yeah.
Okay. Was his voting record on the stadium bills through that period, was he constantly voting against it?
He was against them then, but and he sort of switched along the way.
Yeah, that's what I'm just saying. What was his, I don't recall what his justification was for pushing that legislation and ultimately signing it into law.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing. I remember a couple years earlier in 1987, the year we were first trying to fight it off, both the Speaker of the House, who was a Democrat at the time, and the Minority Leader, the Republican Leader, both of the bill died in one of their committees. The bill to fund the stadium died in committee. It's dead. Well, both leaders went and lobbied members of their own committee. Both of them were strongly opposed to a stadium. Both of them lobbied their own members on that committee to reverse their decision to support the stadium. Well, these guys said they were opposed to it. Why? They knew the public was opposed to it. But they wanted it to happen anyway. So there are a whole lot of people who say they wanted it, they didn't want it to happen, but they would. I mean, one of my colleagues, I can tell you, she because she's scared of her constituency opposing her on it, she will have to vote against the final bill, but every amendment to make it easier for them, she'll vote with the team and the interests of the owner. And because she knows she can't vote for the final bill, she'll help them every step of the way until then.
One thing that struck me when you were talking about Ross Perot's group supporting your bill, and a third party candidate in public financing, how does a third party emerge in something like that? Ross Perot has his own money.
Ventura had name recognition. Yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger, name recognition.
Is there a provision that would allow a third
party? Our public finance system is pretty good for it. I've actually been one who thinks that public finance system should not build a party, nor should it keep a party out of power. It should be neutral to it, and we have, I think, neutral laws in the third and fourth parties in Minnesota. I think we have pretty decent laws on that. And we're one of the few states that does that, that treats them fairly that way. But I think the way we could clean up some of the negative advertising and stuff is if we had what's called instant runoff voting, where, in effect, you can vote for your ideal candidate, and you vote your first, second, third choice. If your ideal candidate's the bottom candidate, then they lose, they're out of the race, and then they count your second vote until one of the candidates gets a majority of the votes. So everybody gets one vote, but if that means you can vote for your ideal candidate, and if they lose, then you can pick the standard candidate that you want. And so you'd have it'd be a fairer system, and that would probably help minor parties more, but there's opposition to that right now. It might happen. There's growing public support for it.
For the third party candidates, how do they get the public funding? Do they need to get a number of signatures or something?
Well, if you qualify to run for office, which means signatures or a $200 filing fee, you are eligible if you sign the agreement. If you're a minor party candidate, you get people who give you in Minnesota. One of our public finance things is if you give $50 to a candidate who's agreeing to the limits, you get a refund from the state of that first $50 you give in a year. And a candidate who abides by the limit, no matter what party, if they file for office and sign the agreement, their contributors can give money to them and get the first $50 refunded. So if you raise $50 contributions, you could get technically all your money in public finance money, even if you're third party. And then there's a checkoff on the thing, on the tax form, and that goes to, some goes to the parties, if you check a party, some goes to the general fund of all the candidates, and that goes to minor parties. And if they, once they become a major party, which is 5%, which is very small number, still minor party, but that's how Ventura's party became a major party. They got 5% or more of the vote one time, so he got all the public financing the next time. So, one last question. Yeah.
One last question on the stadium. Do I understand it right that the stadium owners, I believe that's just Carapola, or the team owner, Twins, are supplied 25% of the money for the stadium, and the state provided 75%. Is there a profit sharing arrangement there with the state?
I tried that. I had a bill to do that. But the Republican legislators had a bill to say, because it was over 75% was public money. And yeah, and over the years they had all kinds of things. The owner would donate. What would he donate? He'd donate the money from naming rights. But we pay for the stadium. He gets to name it and give us the money from the naming. That was his contribution to this. I suggest, why don't we reverse it? Why doesn't he pay for the rest of it? We'll donate the naming rights. If he pays for it, it's his naming rights. We pay for it, it's ours. But that's the racket it was. St. Paul, our current U.S. Senator, when he was mayor of St. Paul, he got pushed through funding for a new hockey arena there. It's a real great deal. He makes it a public stadium. They're all public. So the taxpayers ought to pay for it because it's a public facility. But if St. Paul wants to use their public facility that they own, they can use it 10 times a year free, except they have to pay for all the utilities and the janitors and everything else. If they use it more than 10 times, they have to pay rent to the renter.
Oh my gosh.
We pay for the stadium. Why do they make it a public stadium? One, so they can justify it, and two, that way they don't have any property taxes on it. So it's a real racket, and I think it's bizarre. I wrote a column saying, if what kind of investors, if Ziggy Wilf owns 80% of the team and his brother Mark owns 20% of the team, his brother Mark is going to say, hey, I want 20% of the profits. Well, if we enhance their profits by putting in $500 million worth of this, we should get our share of the enhanced profits.
Well, who cut this deal? I mean, it sounds awful good for the business owners and pretty terrible for the investors in Minnesota.
It is.
Why does anybody want it?
We don't. The public
does. The public does not.
It doesn't want it.
But they've convinced people. I've had so many things about John Murray hates sports because I fight against those. They use any arguments. They don't have to play fair. They'll use any arguments they can, and they get away with it. It's a very, I will close it here by saying that the system is very much in need of repair. It's easy to get cynical, and cynical meaning you give up on the process, but giving up on the process means they win. When they say, we can't let the terrorists win, keep doing what, let's not change things. Well, we shouldn't give, as Peter was talking about, the civil liberties away because the terrorists are making us do that. We shouldn't give in to that. Same thing with this. If there's corruption in politics, we shouldn't give in to it and let the crooks win. We should keep fighting it and change it. And again, I've seen victories, seen defeats on it, and I'm convinced the public's ready for change. We just have to get the public organized and get elected officials to push for it. So with that, thank you for your attention.